Hello, this is Rachel Durkin Durga, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the 8th of October issue of the Toronto Star on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Mark Carney's visit ends with no deal, despite Donald Trump predicting Canada will be, quote, very happy, end quote, with Washington trade talks, by Alex Ballingall. Mutual praise mixed with laughter and predictions of, quote, very happy, end quote, Canadians, as Prime Minister Mark Carney met Tuesday with U.S. President Donald Trump in Washington, D.C., where the American leader projected friendliness even as he repeated his desire to annex Canada into the United States. But despite the show of warmth in Trump's gilded Oval Office, the Canadian delegation ended the day with nothing to announce beyond a statement from a top cabinet minister that talks to end the trade war will continue in hopes of, quote, quickly, end quote, striking deals in the areas the U.S. is targeted with heavy import duties, including Canada's steel and aluminum sector. The government had played down expectations heading into the meeting, leaving some industry stakeholders unsurprised or cautiously optimistic about the result. Others, like the head of the United Steelworkers Union in Canada, called it, quote, one big letdown, end quote, after a display of closeness that left him, quote, disgusted, end quote. Following a lunch of seared beef and endive salad at the White House, Carney left it to Intergovernmental Affairs Minister Dominic LeBlanc to address reporters about what he called, quote, successful, positive, and substantive, end quote, talks. He said Carney and Trump ended the meeting by directing officials to strive soon for deals in areas like steel, aluminum, and energy. Quote, we talked about ways to quickly arrive at a deal that will bring, we hope, a better circumstance to both countries in these sectors of significant importance, end quote, LeBlanc said, describing this as a, quote, first step, end quote, to progress in other areas. Quote, I'm more optimistic today after those discussions at the White House than I was when we arrived in Washington yesterday, but recognize that we still have some work to do, end quote, he said. Earlier, Carney and Trump sat side by side for 35 minutes, flanked by cabinet members and officials and a pack of reporters inside Trump's office. With Carney speaking far less than Trump, the U.S. leader bounced from subject to subject. Canada and the U.S., he said, will, quote, be working together, end quote, on the Golden Dome, the $243 billion missile defense system that Trump said would protect both countries. Trump credited Canada for its efforts to reduce the flow of fentanyl across the border. And he expressed indifference on the question of whether the upcoming review of the current North American trade agreement between Canada, the U.S., and Mexico leads to a renegotiated trilateral deal or splits into separate arrangements with each country. But the U.S. president was clear that he wants to stick to his tariff agenda, even as he heaped praise on Carney's leadership qualities and spoke warmly about Canada, claiming he wants, quote, Canada to do great, end quote, despite the ongoing trade war that Trump started by imposing import duties on billions of dollars of Canadian goods. Quote, he's a world-class leader, end quote, Trump said of Carney, whom he called a, quote, good man, end quote, who could be, quote, very nasty, end quote, when negotiating for Canadian interests. On that score, both Carney and Trump appeared optimistic that common ground could be found on trade, even as they each acknowledge their countries are competing for investment and business activity in a world that has been rattled by Trump's global tariff agenda in recent months. Quote, the problem we have is that they want a car company, and I want a car company, end quote, Trump said, referring to his efforts to use tariffs to disrupt the cross-border auto sector and draw manufacturing into the U.S. Quote, we don't like to compete because we sort of hurt each other when we compete, so we have a natural conflict, end quote, Trump said. Quote, it's a natural business conflict. Asked what could happen at Tuesday's meeting, Trump suggested there would be progress even as he insisted some level of tariffs would remain, and raised his long-standing grievance about Canadian protectionism of agriculture and dairy. Quote, I think they're going to walk away very happy, end quote, Trump said. Carney, meanwhile, repeated the praise he offered Trump at their first White House meeting in May, calling him a, quote, transformational, end quote, figure. He also made the case that Canada is one of the U.S.'s most important trading partners and predicted successful trade talks could see hundreds of billions of dollars in Canadian investment south of the border. Quote, there are areas where we compete, and it's in those areas where we have to come to an agreement that works, end quote, Carney said. Yet alongside the camaraderie, Trump flashed his ambition to make Canada part of the U.S., suggesting that would be a, quote, very easy way, end quote, to resolve the trade conflict. He also interrupted Carney as the prime minister was describing Trump's impact on world affairs, suggesting this might also include, quote, the merger of Canada and the United States, end quote. The comment provoked laughter in the room as Carney responded with a smile that, quote, no, that's not where I was going with that, end quote. Since Carney's last meeting with Trump, shortly after he won a minority government in the April 28 general election, the federal government has refrained from hitting back with matching counter-tariffs as the White House increased import duties on Canadian steel, aluminum, lumber, and copper. At Trump's urging, the Carney Liberals also canceled the long-planned creation of a digital service tax that would have applied to American web giants like Meta and Google. The government also removed counter-tariffs imposed last winter on about $30 billion worth of American imports, while arguing Canada has one of the best situations with a tariff-happy U.S. administration, given that most exports to the country remain duty-free because of the Canada-United States-Mexico Agreement, or CUSMA. But some of the sectors hardest hit have still urged Ottawa to strike back with tariffs on American goods as the trade war drags towards next year's scheduled renegotiation of CUSMA that Trump signed in 2018. In recent months, Canada's unemployment rate has risen to 7.1%, with 66,000 jobs lost in August alone. Among the regions with the highest unemployment are Ontario, regions suffering from tariff impacts, according to Statistics Canada, including Windsor, Oshawa, and Toronto. On Tuesday morning at Queen's Park, Ontario, Premier Doug Ford called on the federal government to shift course and strike back against American tariffs if there is no progress to end the ongoing trade war that has hit key provincial sectors like steel, autos, and forestry. Quote, we can't just keep rolling over to President Trump. As he strengthens his case, we seem to be weakening our case by continuously pulling off tariffs, end quote, Ford said. Later, United Steelworkers National Director Marty Warren said the lack of tangible progress on Tuesday was a, quote, big letdown, end quote, for the sector struggling under 50% import duties into the U.S. Quote, the last time Trump said what good friends we are, a week later he increased the steel tariffs, end quote, Warren said. The union had added that the chummy atmosphere in the Oval Office also rubbed him the wrong way. Quote, I know that's a strategy, but as a Canadian, it disgusted me, end quote, he said. Flavio Volpe, president of the Automotive Parts Manufacturers Association, said he wasn't surprised no deal was announced Tuesday, while he too noted, quote, a level of comfort we haven't seen before, end quote, between the leaders. He also felt Trump's description of Carney as a strong negotiator could be a sign of progress to come, since striking an agreement with a, quote, really tough adversary, end quote, could be spun as more of an accomplishment. Catherine Cobden, the chief executive of the Canadian Steel Producers Association, thought the indication that sectoral deals could happen soon was, quote, notable, end quote. She added, however, that any deal should try to recover as much as possible, quote, the free and open, end quote, trade that existed before Trump's tariffs. Canadian residency language provisions added to bill on citizenship by descent by Nicholas Kung. A parliamentary committee has passed changes to the citizenship bill to limit the passage of citizenship by descent to mirror what's typically required of immigrants to become Canadian citizens. On Tuesday, the Standing Committee on Citizenship and Immigration inserted into Bill C-3 language and knowledge requirements, as well as security checks for foreign-born descendants of Canadian parents who were also born abroad. To inherit Canadian citizenship by descent, those between 18 and 55 years old would need to have an, quote, adequate, end quote, knowledge in English or French, and of the responsibilities and privileges of being a citizen. All adults would also be required to undergo security checks to determine if they would be inadmissible. Instead of the proposed cumulative 1,095-day physical residency required, a foreign-born Canadian citizen would need to have spent those number of days inside Canada in the 5 consecutive years before the birth of their child abroad in order to pass on their citizenship. Prime Minister Mark Carney's government tabled Bill C-3 in June, which is meant to comply with a court order that ruled the current 2-generation cutoff provision of the Citizenship Act is unconstitutional, because it limits the automatic passage of citizenship to the first generation of Canadians who were born outside Canada. The minority Liberal government must pass and implement the bill by November 20th to make the law compliant with the Constitution's Charter of Rights. With the Liberals and Conservatives each holding 4 votes on the committee, Bloc Québécois MP Alexis Brunel-Duceppe from Lac-Saint-Jean held the balance of power in passing the amendments put forward by the Conservative opposition. The MP said he didn't see how these amendments on citizenship by descent would be deemed unconstitutional when the same rules are applied to naturalized Canadians. Quote, everybody should be happy, end quote, said Brunel-Duceppe. Quote, am I wrong, end quote. However, Uyen Huang, Director General of the Immigration Department Citizenship Branch, said there's a distinction between citizenship by descent and the naturalization process. Quote, these people become citizens at the moment of their birth, automatically by operation of law, end quote, Huang told the committee when asked for her opinion on the amendments. Quote, the bill is to restore citizenship to lost Canadians, and with this type of requirement, we could potentially create another cohort of lost Canadians, end quote. The committee will report Bill C-3 as amended to the House of Commons for debate before a final vote at a third reading. Canadian company that employed temporary foreign workers gets record fined for abuses, but workers won't get any money. By Gahada El-Sharif. Estefania, a migrant from Mexico, will not see a cent of the $1 million fine the federal government issued against her former employer, Bolero Shellfish Processing Incorporated, for violating the Temporary Foreign Worker Program, according to Immigration, Refugees, and Citizenship Canada. When Estefania worked at the New Brunswick Seafood Processor in 2023, she said her days often stretched to 12 to 16 hours, cutting and separating lobster by hand. Workers developed muscle pain, arthritis, and allergies, and often injured themselves using sharp tools, but supervisors wouldn't let them seek medical care, she alleged. Quote, they said it wasn't the company's responsibility that people were hurting themselves, end quote, said Estefania, who asked that her full name not be published for fear of reprisal. Quote, they would tell us to keep working or else they wouldn't pay us, end quote. The federal government in September fined Bolero $1 million and banned it from Canada's temporary foreign worker program for 10 years, citing failures to ensure the workplace was free of physical, sexual, psychological, and financial abuse or reprisals. Despite the record fine, the largest ever issued, according to Employment and Social Development Canada, none of the money will go to Estefania or workers who face similar conditions at the hands of other employers, which advocates say leaves them bearing the cost of unsafe or exploitative workplaces, while most places face minimal penalties. While Estefania described what she went through to the Star, the government's fine didn't include details of individual workers' experiences. Bolero, in an email, said it, quote, categorically rejects the conclusions of the federal government, end quote, and will challenge the decision in court. Quote, the conclusions of the federal government do not reflect the reality of Bolero's practices, nor its commitment to the well-being of employees hired under the Temporary Foreign Worker Program, end quote, said spokesperson Gabriel Elbaz, adding that he has, quote, no knowledge of the day-to-day operations, end quote, and could not comment on the treatment of the workers like Estefania. The federal government issued more than $6.8 million in penalties to employers violating the rules of the Temporary Foreign Worker Program from January to September 2025, already surpassing the total from 2024's record-setting year of fines, according to data analyzed by the Star from Immigration, Refugees, and Citizenship Canada. In this time, Ottawa levied 214 fines against non-compliant companies, averaging $31,971 per decision. The Migrant Workers Alliance for Change is calling on Ottawa to compensate migrant workers from fines collected. Quote, these fines are meaningless for the workers who live through the exploitation because they don't see a cent of that money, end quote, said Niger Saravia, an organizer at the Migrant Workers Alliance for Change. Quote, migrants pay the price with their health, livelihoods, and dignity, while most employers walk away with a slap on the wrist, and the government pockets the fines. This isn't justice, it's profiteering off migrant suffering, end quote. In addition to fines, non-compliant companies can face temporary bans on hiring temporary foreign workers, depending upon the severity of violations, though permanent bans are rare. So far this year, around 24 companies have been hit with temporary bans. A trucking company was fined $280,000 and handed a 10-year ban for violating requirements, including offering pay or working conditions that did not match those promised in the job offer, or providing a job different from what was listed. Employment and Social Development Canada said in an email that the increase in penalties, quote, must not be viewed as a sign of widespread abuse. Rather, it reflects the department's stricter oversight and enforcement measures rather than a rise in abuse, end quote. But critics say the enforcement system fails to address the root cause of migrant workers' vulnerability, closed work permits which tie their legal status to a single employer. Advocates have long called for temporary foreign workers to have permanent resident status, giving them the same rights as Canadian workers and the ability to report abusive employers without fear of deportation. There is currently no legal complaints process for migrant workers facing workplace violations, said Syed Hussan, executive director of Migrant Workers Alliance for Change. While workers can submit tips through an online form to report abuse of temporary foreign workers, Hussan said the system lacks legislative or judicial oversight and provides no way for workers to speak directly with enforcement officers or submit evidence. And while the government conducts inspections, they are given notices before the inspection takes place. Quote, workers continue to face removals and deportation while trying to speak up and make complaints, end quote, Hussan said. Quote, the system is designed to fail, and it continues to do so as long as migrants are denied permanent resident status, end quote. For Estefania, who no longer works for Bolero, the government's record fines offer no relief without the protection of permanent status. Quote, if the government is fining employers for their abuses, that money should go to the workers who suffered, end quote, Estefania said. Quote, we are the ones who carry the psychological and financial harm. The compensation must go to those of us who actually lived through those abuses, end quote. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Toronto Star on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. National Guard troops are outside Chicago and could be in Memphis soon in Trump's latest deployment, by Aaron Hooley and Christine Fernando. National Guard troops are positioned outside Chicago and they could be in Memphis by Friday, as the Trump administration pushes ahead with an aggressive policy toward big city crime, whether local leaders support it or not. National Guard members from Texas had settled in at an Army Reserve Center in Illinois by early Wednesday, despite a lawsuit and vigorous opposition from Democratic elected leaders. Their exact mission was not clear, though the Trump administration has an aggressive immigration enforcement operation in the nation's third largest city, and protesters have frequently rallied at an immigration building outside Chicago in Broadview. The president has called Chicago a, quote, hellhole, end quote, of crime, although police statistics show significant drops in most crimes, including homicides. In Memphis, Tennessee, Police Chief Sarah Lynn Davis said a small group of commanders were already in the city, planning for the arrival of Guard troops. Republican Governor Bill Lee has said troops will be deputized by the U.S. Marshals Service to, quote, play a critical support role, end quote, for local law enforcement, though that role hasn't been precisely defined yet. President Donald Trump's bid to deploy the military on U.S. soil over local opposition has triggered a conflict with blue state governors. Illinois and Chicago are urging a federal judge to stop, quote, Trump's long-declared war, end quote, on the state. A court hearing on their lawsuit is scheduled for Thursday. In Oregon, a judge over the weekend blocked the Guard's deployment in Portland. Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker has predicted that National Guard troops from the state would be activated, along with 400 from Texas. He has accused Trump of using troops as, quote, political props and pawns, end quote, and said he didn't get a heads up from Washington about their deployment. The Associated Press saw military personnel in uniforms with the Texas National Guard patch at the U.S. Army Reserve Center in Elwood, 55 miles or 89 kilometers southwest of Chicago. Trucks marked Emergency Disaster Services dropped off portable toilets and other supplies. Trailers were set up in rows. Extra fencing was spread across the perimeter. The nearly 150-year-old Posse Comitatus Act limits the military's role in enforcing domestic laws. However, Trump has said he would be willing to invoke the Insurrection Act, which allows a president to dispatch active duty military in states that are unable to put down an insurrection or are defying federal law. The Federal Aviation Administration ordered flight restrictions over the Army Reserve Center for security reasons until December 6th. Armed Border Patrol agents making arrests near famous landmarks has amplified concerns after an immigration crackdown that began last month. Agents have targeted immigrant-heavy and largely Latino areas. Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson signed an executive order Monday barring federal immigration agents and others from using city-owned property as staging areas for enforcement operations. Since starting his second term, Trump has sent or talked about sending troops to 10 cities, including Baltimore, the District of Columbia, New Orleans, and the California cities of Oakland, San Francisco, and Los Angeles. Most violent crimes around the U.S. have declined in recent years. In Chicago, homicides were down 31% to 278 through August, police data shows. Portland's homicides from January through June decreased by 51% to 17 this year, compared with the same period in 2024. In Portland, months of nightly protests at a U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement facility continued on Tuesday night. In June, police declared a riot, and there have been smaller clashes since then. An appeals court has scheduled arguments for Thursday and the government's bid to deploy the Guard in Portland. Oregon Democratic Governor Tina Kotek said Tuesday she told the Department of Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem there is, quote, no insurrection, end quote, in the state. Portland Police Chief Bob Day said Tuesday that the department needs to work more closely with federal agents as it looks to put more officers at the ICE facility. Noem told Fox News on Tuesday that she told Portland Mayor Keith Wilson that if the city did not boost security at the ICE building, get backup from local law enforcement, and take other safety measures, then, quote, we were going to send four times the amount of federal officers here, end quote. A federal judge in September said the administration, quote, willfully, end quote, broke federal law by putting guard troops in Los Angeles over protests about immigration raids. Lawsuit against Trump's Washington National Guard deployment exposes country's deep partisan divide, by Gary Fields. A partisan battle is playing out in a Washington courtroom that could decide the fate of President Donald Trump's federal law enforcement interventions in the nation's capital. Dozens of states have taken sides in a lawsuit challenging the open-ended National Guard deployment in Washington, with their support falling along party lines. It shows how the law enforcement operation in the nation's capital remains a flashpoint in the Republican president's broadening campaign to send the military to cities across the country and underscores the deepening divisions over the move. The lawsuit, filed September 4th by Washington Attorney General Brian Schwalb, challenges the Trump administration's use of the National Guard in the heavily Democratic city as part of an emergency order issued by Trump to stem what the president called, quote, out of control, end quote, crime. Although the order has lapsed, hundreds of troops are still in the city, which is seeking a preliminary injunction to stop the deployment. With legal action launched against deployments to Portland, Oregon, and Chicago, the case will be closely watched, even though Washington's status as a federal district makes it an outlier. Oral arguments are set to begin October 24th. 23 states have aligned with the Trump administration's stance that the president has the authority to bring in the National Guard, while 22 states back Washington's position. The 23 states supporting the administration have Republican attorneys general, while the other 22 have Democrats. For the states joining in the lawsuit, especially those facing their own interventions, supporting Washington was a way to show solidarity against what they said was presidential overreach. Quote, it is un-American to use the military in any of our cities, absent truly extraordinary circumstances, and a threat against one city is a threat to us all, end quote, said Oregon Attorney General Dan Rayfield, a Democrat who supports Washington. The states supporting Washington said in their filing that the deployment of National Guard units without the city's consent is unlawful, unconstitutional, and undemocratic. It, quote, sets a chilling precedent that threatens the constitutional rights of Americans everywhere, they said, by unlawfully deploying National Guard troops and by threatening to deploy the Guard to every state at his whim, the president has attacked state sovereignty, harmed local jurisdictions, and made us less safe, end quote. Those siding with the administration say Trump is in the right with his National Guard deployment in the District of Columbia. Quote, the district belongs to, quote, the people, end quote, as a whole, and its safety is critical to our constitutional republic, end quote, the 23 states said in a September 16 filing, adding that they, quote, have a profound interest in this case to ensure that President Trump can continue to protect our nation's capital, end quote. The reasoning, they say, is for safety, not just for residents, but for members of Congress and their staffers, as well as administration officials and foreign embassy workers. The filing notes all the groups have been crime victims in Washington in recent years. The states also argue that the Constitution and Congress give presidents enormous authority to protect the district. Quote, it is concerning to have states so divided and polarized, end quote, said Emory University School of Law professor Mark Nevitt, who noted that it was just Republican-led states that have sent guard troops to Washington. The case filings are, quote, a further representation of that divide, end quote. The Washington lawsuit emerged from the presidential order in August that led to roughly 2,000 troops from the District of Columbia National Guard and eight states patrolling public areas, including train stations, subway stations, the National Mall, and other high pedestrian traffic areas. Some have been armed, unnerving residents, although no incidents have been reported. Presidents have authority to call up the National Guard under a variety of circumstances, including to repel a rebellion or invasion, but the legal extent of that is debatable. In the Washington case, states will be looking at what the court says about the president's authority to deploy the Guard, the legality of deploying out-of-state guard units against the wishes of local officials, and whether police powers are deemed to have been encroached upon by the federal intervention. Those arguments could be relevant for any future court cases against the deployments. States on the winning side of the Washington case will likely feel vindicated and may seek to point to it as precedent. But the district's unique status means the legal arguments may be different for states. The president has authorities in Washington that he does not have elsewhere. In states, governors control their own National Guards. In Washington, a federal district, the president is already in charge of the National Guard and arguably can legally deploy troops without congressional approval. To deploy the National Guard to a state usually requires the approval of that state's governor, along with legal reasoning for doing so. Washington will also be looking to rulings in other cases that may be pertinent for its own. A judge ruled last month that the Trump administration broke the law by sending Guard troops to Los Angeles in early June. The 150-year-old Posse Comitatus Act limits the U.S. military's role in enforcing domestic laws unless, quote, expressly, end quote, authorized by the Constitution or Congress. William Banks, professor emeritus of law at Syracuse University, said he believes the president is within his authority to call up the National Guard in Washington and then to federalize other guard units in the city, even if Americans, quote, don't like the involvement of the military in civilian activities, end quote, because of statute. It is a federal district, not a state, he said. Experts differ over how they think the case will play out. The court's rulings could range from saying the president is within his authority in calling up the D.C. National Guard, as well as units from other states, to calling the deployments an unlawful expansion of presidential authority. Margaret Hu, a professor at the William & Mary School of Law, said that the court first has to decide if Trump used the law correctly, and even then, it must decide whether this was an appropriate use of the National Guard. Quote, part of what D.C. is arguing when they say this is an illegal deployment is that it violates the spirit of the law the Constitution requires, end quote, to give states and jurisdictions autonomy to police their citizens, Hu said. Quote, there are complex questions the court has to answer, end quote. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Toronto Star on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Hamas and Israel enter a third day of Gaza peace talks with top Trump envoy expected to join, by Sami Magdi. Israel and Hamas entered a third day of peace talks at an Egyptian resort Wednesday, with more senior officials from the United States, Israel, and mediating countries expected to join, a sign that negotiators aim to tackle the toughest issues of an American plan to end the war in Gaza. Hamas says it is seeking firm guarantees from U.S. President Donald Trump and mediators that Israel will not resume its military campaign in the Palestinian territory after the militant group releases all the remaining hostages. All sides have expressed optimism for a deal to end the two-year war, with tens of thousands of Palestinians killed and most of the Gaza Strip destroyed. But key parts of the peace plan have still not been pinned down, including requirements that Hamas disarm, the timing and extent of an Israeli troop withdrawal from Gaza, and the creation of an international body to run Gaza after Hamas steps down from power. Qatar's Prime Minister and top diplomat, Sheikh Mohammed bin Abdulrahman Al Thani, was heading to the Egyptian coastal city of Sharm el-Sheikh to join the talks. Also expected Wednesday were Trump's Mideast envoy, Steve Witkoff, and the president's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, according to a U.S. official who was not authorized to talk to reporters because the trip has not been formally announced. From Israel, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's top advisor, Ron Dermer, was also to join, an Israeli official said, speaking on condition of anonymity because they were not authorized to speak to the media. As Qatari, Egyptian, and U.S. mediators meet with both sides in preliminary talks on Wednesday morning, a senior Hamas official, Taher Nunu, said the group has exchanged a list of Palestinian prisoners it seeks to release in return for Israeli hostages under the deal's terms. The plan calls for an immediate ceasefire and release of the 48 hostages that militants in Gaza still hold from their October 7, 2023 surprise attack on Israel that started the war and triggered Israel's devastating retaliation. Around 20 of the hostages are believed to still be alive. It envisages Israel withdrawing its troop from Gaza after Hamas disarms and an international security force being put in place. The territory would be placed under international governance, with Trump and former UK Prime Minister Tony Blair overseeing it. Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi said Wednesday in televised comments that the negotiations so far, quote, were very encouraging, end quote. Netanyahu has accepted Trump's plan. His office said Tuesday that Israel was, quote, cautiously optimistic, end quote, framing the talks as technical negotiations over a plan that both sides already had approved. In a statement Tuesday, Hamas reiterated its long-standing demands for a lasting ceasefire and a full Israeli withdrawal from Gaza, but said nothing about disarmament, a step it has long resisted. Hamas has also spoken against the idea of international rule, though it has agreed it will have no role in governing post-war Gaza. Speaking in Sharm el-Sheikh, Khalil al-Hayya, Hamas's top negotiator, told Egypt's Qahira TV that the group wanted solid guarantees from Trump and mediators that the war, quote, will not return, end quote. It appears to be his first public appearance since an Israeli strike targeting him and other Hamas leaders in Qatar last month killed 6 people, including his son and office manager. In January, the two sides had a ceasefire that brought the release of some Israeli hostages in exchange for Palestinians imprisoned by Israel. Under the agreement, which Trump and Witikoff played a major role in brokering, the two sides were then supposed to enter negotiations over a long-term truce, an Israeli withdrawal, and a full hostage release. But Israel broke the ceasefire in March, resuming its campaign of bombardment and offensives, saying it aimed to pressure Hamas for the remaining hostage releases. Past rounds of negotiations have frequently fallen apart over the same obstacle, with Hamas demanding assurances of the war's end and Netanyahu vowing to keep fighting until the group is destroyed. The Trump plan attempts to resolve all the issues at once by laying out Hamas's disarmament and a post-war scenario for governing the territory with provisions for a massive reconstruction campaign. In the Hamas-led attack 2 years ago, militants stormed into southern Israel and killed around 1,200 people, mostly civilians, and abducted 251. Most hostages have since been released in ceasefires or other deals. A growing number of experts, including those commissioned by a UN body, have said Israel's offensive in Gaza amounts to genocide, an accusation Israel denies. More than 67,000 Palestinians have been killed in Gaza, and nearly 170,000 wounded, according to Gaza's health ministry. The ministry, which does not differentiate between civilians and combatants, but says around half of the deaths were women and children, is part of the Hamas-run government. The United Nations and many independent experts consider its figures to be the most reliable estimate of wartime casualties. In the Gaza Strip, where much of the territory lies in ruins, Palestinians are desperate for a breakthrough. Thousands fleeing Israel's latest ground offensive in northern Gaza and Gaza City have set up makeshift tents along the beach in the central part of the territory, sometimes using blankets for shelter. Quote, there is no food nor good water and blockage of crossings, end quote, said Suleiman Abu Afesh, a displaced woman from Gaza City. Quote, our kids sleep in the streets, we buy drinking water, where do we go? There's no mercy, end quote. Sarah Rehan, a displaced woman from Jabalia, said she was praying for an end to the war. Quote, I hope we return to our places and homes, even if there are no homes, end quote, she said. Quote, our existence in our land is the biggest happiness for us, end quote. More than 80% of health facilities in eastern Congo are out of medicine, Red Cross says, by Jean-Yves Kamale. Over 200 health facilities in eastern Congo are experiencing shortages of medicines as a result of fighting in the region and a lack of humanitarian funding, the International Committee of the Red Cross said Wednesday. The Red Cross said it assessed 240 health centers and clinics in North and South Kivu, two provinces where the Rwanda-backed M23 rebels made an unprecedented advance earlier this year, further deepening one of the world's largest humanitarian crises. The difficulties in crossing front lines in the war-hit regions have prevented health facilities from getting access to medicine, even when it is available, the ICRC said. Quote, the lives of thousands of people are at stake, end quote, due to the shortage of essential medicine against malaria, HIV, tuberculosis, and other diseases. Francois Morillon, the head of the ICRC's delegation in Congo, said during a news conference Wednesday. Many humanitarian organizations supporting health facilities in the region have been forced to reduce their work or shut down because of a lack of funding, he said. Quote, currently more than 80% of health facilities in the Kivu provinces receive no support from humanitarian partners and are only operational thanks to the remarkable commitment of their staff on both sides of the front lines, end quote, Morillon said. Many health workers have also fled the war-torn regions, leading to staff shortages in almost half of the facilities assessed by the ICRC, according to the organization. Congo's mineral-rich east has long been battered by fighting involving more than 100 armed groups, including the Rwanda-backed M23 rebels. The rebels seized the provincial capitals Goma and Bukavu earlier this year, escalating the decades-old conflict. The rebels' advance has killed some 3,000 people this year and worsened what was already one of the world's largest humanitarian crises, with around 7 million people displaced. While fighting has largely decreased as a result of peace efforts, there are still clashes and civilians are still being killed. Police in Australia seize guns from dozens of owners who hold views rejecting government authority, by Charlotte Graham McClay. Police in Western Australia have seized guns and revoked or suspended firearms permits from dozens of owners linked to what investigators describe as sovereign citizen ideologies, or views that reject government authority. Officials linked the crackdown on firearms users believed to hold such views to the fatal shooting in August of two police officers in Victoria State in the country's east. The suspect in those killings, 56-year-old Desi Freeman, remains at large, weeks after he is said to have killed two officers visiting his rural property to serve a search warrant. In the years before the shooting, Freeman appeared to have embraced so-called sovereign citizen views during court appearances. Members of such movements use debunked legal theories to reject government authority. Freeman is suspected of killing Detective Senior Constable Neil Thompson and Senior Constable Vadim Dewart Houtart and wounding a third officer. Following the shooting, investigators in Western Australia used bolstered gun laws enacted in 2024 to identify weapons owners in their state who they said held similar views to Freeman's. Quote, the mission of this operation was simple, and that was to validate and verify our intelligence on who may hold sovereign citizen ideologies here in Western Australia, end quote, the state's police commissioner, Colonel Blanche, told reporters on Sunday. Social media posts and information from other gun owners was used to identify those targeted. Officers visited 70 properties over 5 days in late September and early October, seizing 135 firearms and suspending or revoking 44 gun licenses, Blanche said. Investigators relied on a legal provision that allows only someone who meets the standard of a, quote, fit and proper person, end quote, to hold a gun permit. Quote, if you have made it very clear that you do not abide by the laws of Western Australia set by the Parliament, then there is no way that you can be a fit and proper person, end quote, Blanche said. In explaining the raids, Blanche said that in the past 3 years, six police officers in four states have been shot dead by members of the public, which he said was, quote, unprecedented, end quote, in Australia. In 2022, two officers were shot and killed by Christian extremists at a rural property in Queensland state. The three shooters in that case, conspiracy theorists who reportedly hated the police, were shot and killed by officers after a six-hour siege in the region of Wyambilla. A South Australia police officer was shot dead in 2023. Another was killed in Tasmania in June. Shooting deaths in Australia are otherwise rare. A 1996 massacre in the Tasmanian town of Port Arthur, where a lone gunman killed 35 people, prompted the government to drastically tighten gun laws and made it much more difficult for Australians to acquire firearms. When Western Australia's tighter gun laws were enacted last June, the state's government boasted that they were the strongest in the country. The changes included limiting the number of guns someone can own to 10 for most people. Meanwhile, in rural Victoria, Australia's largest ever tactical police operation continues the search for Freeman. Hundreds of officers have traversed rugged landscapes, squeezed into caves, and checked mine shafts with no confirmed sightings of the fugitives so far. The August 26 killings happened when 10 armed police officers tried to execute a search warrant at Freeman's property in Porepunkah, a town of just over 1,000 people located 320 kilometers or 200 miles northeast of the city of Melbourne. The suspect, Freeman, fled alone on foot and heavily armed into dense surrounding forest. He is experienced in wilderness survival skills, officials said. Victoria's Police Commissioner Mike Bush did not offer a reason for the search of Freeman's property at the time, but he told reporters that attending officers included members of a unit that investigates sexual offences and child abuse. Australian news outlets widely reported that Freeman espoused sovereign citizen beliefs, citing a 2021 video taken in Wangaratta Magistrates Court and published online, in which he can be seen attempting unsuccessfully to arrest a magistrate and police officers during a hearing. In a 2024 finding from Victoria's Supreme Court, where Freeman tried to challenge a lengthy suspension of his driver's license, a judge wrote the man had, quote, a history of unpleasant encounters with police officers, end quote, whom he referred to in his submissions to the court as, quote, Nazis, end quote, and, quote, terrorist thugs, end quote. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Toronto Star on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Molecular discovery that won Nobel Prize in chemistry is likened to, quote, Harry Potter, Enchanted Handbag, by Kostia Menikov and Stephanie Dazio. Three scientists won the Nobel Prize in Chemistry on Wednesday for their development of metal organic frameworks that could eventually help reduce pollution and combat climate change. A member of the Nobel Committee likened the discovery to Hermione Granger's seemingly bottomless enchanted handbag in the fictional Harry Potter series, in that the frameworks may look small from the outside, but are able to hold surprisingly vast quantities within them. The Nobel Committee said Susuma Kitagawa, Richard Robson, and Omar M. Yagi were being awarded for, quote, groundbreaking discoveries, end quote, saying, quote, some of these may contribute to solving some of humankind's greatest challenges, end quote. From capturing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere or sucking water out of dry desert air, the trio's new form of molecular architecture can absorb and contain gases inside stable metal organic frameworks. The frameworks can be compared to the timber framework of a house and Hermione's famous beaded handbag in that they are all small on the outside but very large on the inside, according to Olof Ramström, a member of the Nobel Committee for Chemistry. The chemists worked separately but added to each other's breakthroughs, which began in 1989 with Robson. Quote, metal organic frameworks have enormous potential, bringing previously unforeseen opportunities for custom-made materials with new functions, end quote, Heiner Linke, chair of the Nobel Committee for Chemistry, said in a news release. The committee cited the potential for using the frameworks to separating so-called, quote, forever chemicals, end quote, from water. Perfluoroalkyl and polyfluoroalkyl substances, or PFAS, are a group of chemicals that have been around for decades and have now spread into the air, water, and soil. They are also referred to as, quote, forever chemicals, end quote. Hans Ellegren, Secretary General of the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences, announced Wednesday's prize in Stockholm. It was the third prize announced this week. Robson, 88, is affiliated with the University of Melbourne in Australia. Kitagawa, 74, is with Japan's Kyoto University, and Yagi, 60, with the University of California, Berkeley. Kitagawa spoke to the committee and the press over the phone Wednesday after his win was announced. Quote, I'm deeply honored and delighted that my long-standing research has been recognized, end quote, he said. The 88-year-old Robson, in a phone call with the Associated Press from his home in Melbourne, Australia, said he was, quote, very pleased, of course, and a bit stunned as well, end quote. Quote, this is a major thing that happens late in life when I'm not really in a condition to withstand it all, end quote, he said. Quote, but here we are, end quote. The 2024 prize was awarded to David Baker, a biochemist at the University of Washington in Seattle, and to Demise Hassabis and John Jumper, computer scientists at Google DeepMind, a British-American artificial intelligence research laboratory based in London. The three were awarded for discovering powerful techniques to decode and even design novel proteins, the building blocks of life. Their work used advanced technologies, including artificial intelligence, and holds the potential to transform how new drugs and other materials are made. The first Nobel of 2025 was announced Monday. The prize in medicine went to Mary E. Brunkow, Fred Ramsdell, and Dr. Shimon Sakaguchi for their discoveries concerning peripheral immune tolerance. Tuesday's physics prize went to John Clark, Michael H. Dvorak, and John M. Martinez for their research on the weird world of subatomic quantum tunneling that advances the power of everyday digital communications and computing. This year's Nobel announcements continue with the Literature Prize Thursday. The Nobel Peace Prize will be announced Friday, and the Economics Prize next Monday. The awards ceremony will be held December 10th, the anniversary of the death of Alfred Nobel, who founded the prizes. Nobel was a wealthy Swedish industrialist and the inventor of dynamite. He died in 1896. Ontario to speed up access to select cancer drugs by up to 1 year in new pilot, by Hannah Alberga. Ontario says it will speed up the lengthy approval process for select cancer drugs by up to 1 year as part of a new pilot project. Ontario Health Minister Sylvia Jones announced the three-year fast-track program at Princess Margaret Cancer Centre in Toronto. Jones says 7 to 10 high-priority cancer drugs that are approved by Health Canada through Project Orbis will be expedited in each year of the pilot. The federal government joined Project Orbis, an international initiative launched in 2019, to get patients promising cancer treatments sooner. The Ontario Ministry of Health says it takes about 2 years in Canada for a newly approved drug to reach a patient, a year longer than in other developed countries. Jones says the province will start the process of publicly funding select new drugs while pan-Canadian pricing negotiations are still underway with drug manufacturers. Typically, public drug program funding doesn't begin until after the negotiations. The Pan-Canadian Pharmaceutical Alliance said last week it was seeking input on an early negotiation process that would speed up public drug coverage for Canadian patients. Southern right whales awe admirers in Patagonia after coming back from brink of extinction, by Victor Caivano and Ramiro Barrero. After coming back from the brink of extinction, southern right whales are swimming in greater numbers off the coast of Argentina's Patagonia this year, delighting tourists seeking to catch a glimpse of their acrobatics. Peninsula Valdez, located in the Patagonian province of Chubut, is globally important for the conservation of marine mammals and is home to a key breeding population of southern right whales, once an endangered species, as well as elephant seals and sea lions. Quote, I've seen whales in Canada and California, but this was the best and probably the largest number of whales I've ever seen in my life, end quote, said Tino Wentz, a German tourist who recently visited the peninsula with his girlfriend. The southern right whale was nearly exterminated by hunting expeditions up until the last century. Before large-scale whaling began, the population in southern waters was estimated at around 100,000, before it was decimated to about 600. Since then, it has slowly recovered to roughly 4,700 whales around Peninsula Valdez today. Whale watching season in the South American country peaks between August and September. This year, more than 2,000 whales have been spotted, though the actual number is likely higher, scientists say. Vence, 24, and his partner joined Argentine Andrea Delfino and her children on a boat trip. Southern winds stirred the whales into more acrobatic breaching, a spectacle that leaves an indelible impression on those who witness it. Other tourists preferred to watch the whales from the shore, as is common in neighboring Brazil or Uruguay. Watching from the beach, Augustina Guidolin fulfilled her dream of witnessing, quote, the immensity that borders on the magical and the wild, end quote. The tourists were at El Doradillo Park, a protected natural area in Puerto Madryn, where whales spend time close to shore with their young after giving birth. In addition to Peninsula Valdez and other points in Patagonia, the whales' migration route extends along Uruguay's eastern coast and southern Brazil. Santiago Fernandez, a biologist with Argentina's National Scientific and Technical Research Council, is part of a project that since 1999 has carried out 2 to 3 aerial surveys each year along 640 kilometers or 400 miles of Patagonian coastline. This year's count recorded 2,100 whales, 863 of them mothers with calves, and the rest solitary individuals. Quote, we're underestimating the number of whales in the area, end quote, Fernandez said of the census, noting that it represents only a snapshot since whales move in and out of the same region as they migrate. He explained that in 1999, about 500 whales were counted along that same route, and that, quote, we're currently seeing a 3% annual growth rate, end quote. Fernandez added that another project, Following Whales, conducted by several national and international organizations, tracks individual whales via satellite telemetry within the San Matias Gulf to the north, the San Jorge Gulf to the south, and beyond to better understand their routes. From that project, which began in 2014, scientists learned that once the calves grow, the mothers lead them deeper into the gulfs. Whales that are therefore not included in the aerial census. The growing population is leading to a dispersal, especially of juveniles and mothers that have already calved, toward the San Matias and San Jorge Gulfs, and even as far north as the coast of Buenos Aires province. This expansion also brings the whales closer to risks posed by human activity, such as fishing nets and boat propellers, researchers have found, based on injuries suffered by whales unable to return to Antarctica at the end and beginning of their natural cycle. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the 8th of October issue of the Toronto Star. Your reader has been Rachel Durkin-Durga. Thank you for listening.